Ladies and gentlemen, Cecil Brown.
Tonight, the grief of one widow in Washington is shared by people everywhere. When Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt was informed of the death of her husband, her first words were these. She said, "I am more sorry for the people of America and the world than I am for us." Mrs. Roosevelt must have said that because she well knew what her husband represented to the world. She put her grief second to the men, women, and children whose hopes and dreams of a better world were fixed on President Roosevelt. He was the father image for those Americans who recognize the real heritage of America. That is, those people who want to obey the instructions of the men who founded this country and said that all men are created equal and have certain inalienable rights. Not often does America have a president who, even at his death, even before history has a chance to pass judgment, can sit beside Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Wilson. President Roosevelt at once takes his position beside those other great presidents. And that is why tonight people everywhere are saying, "Why did he have to die when we need him so much?" Those who needed Mr. Roosevelt are the people who are fighting and striving to create a world of decency, justice, and equality. For President Roosevelt was the skillful champion of the men and women who are fighting to create the four freedoms. He had that vision, but what the world recognized also, he had the skill, the timing, and the personal characteristics which were helping to bring the four freedoms into practice. That is why Mrs. Roosevelt said, "I feel more sorry for the people of America and the world." Now, those people, steel workers, farmers, housewives, businessmen, soldiers, high school students, truck drivers, people in every economic group here in America and in dozens of other countries, may well be wondering, who will be our crusader now for a better, more stable, more decent world? And also, they may well be asking themselves, will the progress President Roosevelt brought about now be frittered away? The new president, Harry S. Truman, remains to prove himself. He is under the great handicap of trying to fill the place of a man who, while he may not have been considered indispensable, was enough so that people are wondering who is to carry on an effective fight for a better, more democratic world. President Truman is a devoted disciple of the president. He saw eye to eye with him on foreign and domestic affairs. But of course, he does not have the experience that Roosevelt had. And whether he has the skill in high negotiations remains to be determined. On the record, Harry Truman's ideals and desires for more economic equality and world cooperation are the same as those of Franklin Roosevelt. But Mr. Roosevelt was an expert technician in the art of government. President Truman is about to be tested in that art. Mr. Roosevelt also bequeathed to the nation the concrete achievements of the past 12 years. Many of his domestic reforms are here to stay, not just because both the Democrat and Republican parties approve of them, but because the vast majority of the American citizens don't want to turn back to the days before Roosevelt. So perhaps above everything else, President Roosevelt gave the American people a chart, a map, showing a road to travel. It was bumpy in spots and still is. But it's evident that the American people have no wish to take detours or be so frightened of the bumps that we wish to turn back. President Truman, as the partner of Mr. Roosevelt, is going to continue America on that road. So people everywhere still have a crusader in the Roosevelt tradition. And now President Truman has the high duty to show his skill, his technique, and his effectiveness in reaching the Roosevelt objectives. He starts out at a time that has its advantages for him and the nation, and also pitfalls and dangers. Most important, he becomes commander-in-chief when victory is very near in Germany and when victory is inevitable in the Pacific. The military machines of the United Nations are running on all 12 and will continue to do so. More need on the machinery to preserve the only a start. Part for the gradual reconversion of America's economy, But on the home front, very serious economic problems face the nation, just as they do abroad. The job of reconversion is one that is taxing all the ingenuity and skill of the is inevitable in the Pacific. It has its advantages for him and the nation, and also pitfalls and dangers. Most important, he becomes commander-in-chief when victory is very near in Germany, and when victory is inevitable in the Pacific. The military machines of the United Nations are running on all 12 and will continue to do so. Moreover, a tremendous start has been made on the machinery to preserve the peace afterwards, but only a start. And the machinery has been set up in part for the gradual reconversion of America's economy. But on the home front, very serious economic problems face the nation, just as they do abroad. The job of reconversion is one that is taxing all the ingenuity and skill of the officials of government, business, and the unions. The cooperation between those three groups has been rather good during the war, but the tensions are increasing as Germany goes down to defeat. The heat is being generated in Washington to ease up on many wartime controls, and the fight is growing sharper to break down many of the barriers to inflation. And now the champion defender of all has gone. On foreign affairs, it's to be expected that President Truman will take a time to gain an understanding of all the intricate issues. As you may have heard by now, Truman said that the World Security Conference at San Francisco will be held as scheduled, that is, on April 25th. Many other critical issues were facing Roosevelt in foreign affairs, and now they are in the hands of Truman. Some of the most urgent concern Russia. President Roosevelt stretched out a welcoming hand to Russia soon after he took office, and despite some gaps and deviations, Roosevelt's program of friendship for Russia ended up, as you all know, with Russia as our necessary partner in this war. The partnership is not all that it should be or even has to be, and President Truman has anything but an easy job to make it so. One of the immediate issues is to reach agreement on the new Polish government. Another is to reach final agreements on the treatment of the German people and the controls of Germany. In the Pacific theater, Moscow has removed the treaty barrier to the Russians joining in the war against Japan. But it may well be that Russian military and political strategy in the Pacific has not yet been integrated with our own and the British program. That integration may be one of President Truman's jobs. It will be when Russia goes to war against Japan. There is no shortage of grave issues facing the man who sits in the White House tonight. His sorrow at the death of his chief is great, but also great must be his sense of the high trust that Mr. Roosevelt, the American people, and the world are now putting in his hands. But President Truman has one advantage that stands above his own fervent hopes and personal integrity, and that advantage is that President Roosevelt created the organization and charted the free and inspiring road for America and the world to travel.
You have just heard Cecil Brown. Now, Charles Hodges.
The forthcoming conference on world security at San Francisco will test the power of a great man's idea. For President Roosevelt had doubled his stakes on post-war organization at San Francisco. He gambled on getting the United Nations to agree to the new setup, and he gambled on getting the United States to back it. The very core of his idea was and is the use of force against any nation threatening the peace of the world again. He knew that this underwriting of peace with military power, not words, is the boldest international proposal ever laid before the American people. Therefore, the very heart of Mr. Roosevelt's problem was to gain the assent of the Americans for the employment of this international force. This meant, and it means, gaining the assent of the Congress of the United States to military action in advance of war itself. It obviously changes the whole concept of a declaration of war. He wouldn't be waiting for a Pearl Harbor. He would be given the power to stop a Pearl Harbor before it starts. Congress really would be handing the president a blank check on his constitutional right to declare war under certain circumstances. President Roosevelt had made up his mind on this point. he had come to the conviction that there cannot be peace without giving the United Nations the means to maintain it. Therefore, he chose to commit this country, and he dedicated himself to leading the other nations of the world toward a policy of using preventive force, simply providing the international force of the United Nations to beat a disturber of world peace to the punch. He did this because he knew the nature of future warfare, its outbreak without warning, its instantaneous worldwide menace. President Roosevelt knew something else, how closely our world neighbors have been watching us. He had no illusions about Pollyanna wartime friendships. He knew that San Francisco posed a great problem for him. This problem tied up the international and the national politics of peace in a tight knot. Mr. Roosevelt certainly realized that unless the United States stood ready to use its war-made might for peace without debate, the other nations of the world wouldn't commit themselves either. His job, therefore, at San Francisco was to make the issue plain, both to our allies and to ourselves. This required, and it now requires more than ever, the assurance that the United States will accept this new obligation, not to meet force with eventual force, but to make post-war commitments for the creation of the United Nations power to enforce peace at once against war makers. President Roosevelt knew, as our new president knows, that Churchill and Stalin won't go along with the United Nations plan without full American participation. In this respect, it's the old League of Nations dilemma over again. Nothing will work in this world without the United States. President Roosevelt was a past master at shuttling back and forth between foreign and domestic issues, but he knew that at San Francisco, both angles were converging upon him. The security parley was to have been President Roosevelt's meeting with high destiny. All his powers of persuasion, national and international, were being mobilized. To his successor falls the task of making the San Francisco parley work. It is all that stands between us and that eventual next war. And it is important for you to remember one thing. President Roosevelt was a man who had real respect for President Truman. He knew that he could trust the new president to meet the onerous demands of this moment of American decision.
And now we bring you up and close a personal friend of President Truman speaking to you from Mutual Studios in Hollywood.
We'll have to get used to saying President Harry S. Truman. He's such an unassuming and likable chap. He's so nice even to those who have opposed him politically, as I have, that it's a little hard to think of him in the robes of honor of the chief executive of the land. And he won't mind if we think of him just as a fine fellow, a nice chap, and a good guy. But no matter who liked Harry Truman, and everybody liked him, or who did not like the thought of his being in chief office of the land, and some of them did not like that, in this crisis, every American is heart and soul Harry Truman's friend. We couldn't be otherwise and be friends to ourselves as American citizens and friends to our country as the United States of America. And knowing Harry Truman, I know he feels friendly tonight to every American and appreciative of the friendship and support of every American. Never in the history of our country has a man gone into the presidency with so little animosity from any side at all. And it's also true that never has a man gone into the White House with a wider experience and observation of American political customs, both good and bad, as well as experience in official procedures of our government. And all of this is quite aside from Mr. Truman's own ability, which it remains for him to prove with the utmost of sympathy and patriotic loyalty on the part of us, the citizens. Very difficult indeed have been the positions of men in our history who have taken over office from a president who has died or been forced to leave office in the midst of a great crusade. We think of Andrew Johnson following the assassinated Abraham Lincoln, and Warren G. Harding following the Woodrow Wilson who broke in the midst of his crusade for international peace. But Andrew Johnson took office in the midst of a great bitterness and was a bitter man himself. Warren Harding inherited both partisan feuds and a growing public indifference to the efforts to establish international comity. There's a vast and comforting difference in the situation which President Harry S. Truman enters tonight. There is no bitterness in the man's soul, and there's no bitterness among any American group against him that I know of. And there's no indifference of our people tonight to the theme of ending wars through an international organization. The American people show their intense desire by their clamor for an organization based on justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Close. You have just heard a special series of comments prepared by Mr. Cecil Brown, Mr. Charles Hodges, and Mr. Upton Close. This program came to you from New York and Hollywood. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.